I'm Nick Dearden, and this is Counterpower, the podcast for global solidarity. We've never been totally free of fascism. When I was first getting involved in activism in the 1990s, the British National Party was on the rise. On Tower Hamlets Council in East London, they won their first seat. They were organising openly out of a shopfront in Welling that they called their national headquarters. And fascist thugs were beating up Asian youths on Brick Lane. Back then, the British National Party were beaten by a massive anti-racist movement. They retreated back to the smoke-filled side rooms of pubs, away from any public presence. But this fringe street fascism seems very different to what we're now living through. Indeed, fascism sometimes feels like the new normal. It's not only gone global, but ironically for nationalists, it's built its own international institutions and networks. And on today's show, we're going to tell this story. Joining me to talk through the new far-right internationalism is Seema Saeeda from the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants and co-author of Creeping Fascism, and Luke Cooper, author of Authoritarian Contagion and an academic at the London School of Economics. Stay tuned to find out more. Seema, Luke, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Nick.
Luke, this is a successor podcast to the Another Europe is Possible podcast that you've been running, I think, around 100 episodes you've created.
Something like that, yeah.
How does it feel?
No, it's good. It's good. The podcast has flown the nest. As our regular listeners will know, we got a little infrequent recently, and it's great to be doing this again with a bigger team and as a collaborative effort. So, yeah, really excited to be here on my first Counterpower.
And it's great to see everyone's faces on video.
Oh, yeah, video. Yeah. Scary, I know. Yeah, not used to that.
Seema, you are used to the media, though. You've been all over the airwaves in your new job, but also before. But you're now working solidly on immigration. It feels like we've been saying this for years, but it's a hard subject to work on. It just seems to be getting worse and worse. How are you finding it?
To be honest with you, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. We're in a really, really scary moment. And migrants, Muslims, people of colour, we are being targeted directly by the far right, by the fascists. And the battle on the airwaves, that media war, is something that we as a left need to collectively get better at. And we do need to communicate in a much bolder, much braver way. And I think the good thing is that we are now seeing more champions of migration, people like Zach Polanski, for instance, who aren't afraid to come out there and challenge the narrative. But I do think that that work, which I'm obviously part of doing, is super important. And I hope we'll see more and more people who are willing to come out and say things like they are in the media.
Brilliant. Thank you. And I'll stay with you. You wrote this book with the great thinker and activist Neil Faulkner called Creeping Fascism 7-8 years ago now. It was kind of controversial in progressive circles at the time. Could you tell us a bit about what the purpose of the book is and why it was controversial?
So at that time, Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, there were big figures on our screens, big figures in our media. It seems almost such a long time ago, and the way that Farage and Trump are dominating now, you almost forget that they actually were there 10 years ago in the same way almost that they are now. And so what we saw was that in these figures was the contemporary form of fascism. And the way that someone like Donald Trump could assume the presidency using electoral and so-called democratic means was a sign that fascism was creeping upon us. It wasn't coming to us with jackboots on the ground and big paramilitaries. It was taking power through these electoral mechanisms. And the book was a warning sign that we needed to mobilise and organise to defeat the snake of fascism. And it was controversial because using this F word, the fascism word, is controversial amongst many left-wing circles. There's lots of debates about what the word means. But also we had Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party at the time, and there was a lot of electoralism going around. There were people who felt quite confident that if only we could elect Jeremy Corbyn, then all of this nonsense around Farage and Brexit and the far right would disappear. And actually, that's what motivated me to also join Another Europe is Possible and get involved, because we could see that We needed Corbynism to tackle this anti-migrant hatred on the head. We needed Corbynism to say Brexit was a racist project and that there was no space for that kind of racism in our movement. We needed the trade union movement to mobilise at that time and stand with migrant workers as well as the broader white working class, and to stand up for the multiracial working class. We needed that at that time. And what we're seeing today is the result of actually the failure of our joined labour movement forces to tackle that head on. And it's just getting worse and worse. And I think now more than ever is the time for that bold and brave stand.
Brilliant. It definitely feels like it was ahead of its time and that in some ways the rest of society has caught up. Luke, what's your take on all of this? And could you maybe put it in a longer historical context?
Yeah, sure. I suppose my confession is that I'm probably one of the people who's a bit more circumspect on the use of the fascism label, right? Because it is the most extreme vocabulary in some ways that we can reach for. I mean, in your book with Neil at the time, Seema, I thought the term creeping was doing quite a lot of work, right? So it was describing a direction that society was at risk of heading in, and also talking, as you said, about like the electoral form that this was taking. And so I guess I would still hold on to some of that hesitancy, because now in the United States, I think you can see the crystallization of a movement that really looks very fascist. And I don't think you should necessarily analyze fascism as a tick box exercise. But if you did, my God, you would find a lot of those boxes ticked right now in the United States. Cult of personality, a quasi-paramilitary force in the form of ICE, a clear attack on democratic institutions, and this ultra-nationalist and even territorial expansionist ideology. So tick, 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 tick away. And I suppose in terms of the historical origins, we could also think about maybe a contrast between the type of politics that Farage represents and that Trump over time has come to represent. So you were talking in the introduction, Nick, about the 1990s as this origin point. And that seems to me really important in the global story as well. It's been partly lost now, but the fall of the Soviet Union did create a rise of massive street movements in Russia and former Soviet republics and communist states of Eastern Europe that was discussed quite widely in the mainstream media at the time, usually in quite a superficial way, that it was like filling an ideological vacuum or something like that. But you really saw an economy in that moment disintegrating, a rise of criminality, and many of those criminals were taking up this ultra-nationalist ideology. And then I think the other reference point that's talked about more today is the Freedom Party in Austria in 1999 and its electoral breakthrough. And I think that's an interesting story for us right now. The Freedom Party are ascendant in the Austrian opinion polls right now, but Austria is still a constitutional republic. And I think that's helpful for looking at what's happening in the US right now, because it's a struggle. The US is not a fascist state, but it does have a very fascistic or fascist inclined government that's trying to destroy its democratic institutions. But Nick, I would be really interested in what you think about this, because what you started by saying about the anti-BNP movement in the 1990s, looking back, what do you see as the similarities, differences, continuities between then and now?
So I think we had a very limited and specific view of what fascism was, because our experience of it was almost entirely thugs on the street. I mean, that's why the election on Tower Hamlets Council of Derek Beacon was such a big thing, because it seemed incredible that they could get a single councillor elected. You mainly came face to face with them when they were wandering around. I mean, we're in East London now, right? And I mean, it was very, very dangerous at the time for Muslims, for Asian people, even though they are, like, there's a lot of them in this area, but nonetheless, it was very dangerous because they were trying to whip up that kind of division in this area, and people were beaten up and people were killed. And even, you know, as a gay man, I mean, there were people murdered in London in the 90s. It seems kind of incredible now. I think it's important to remember that in terms of how far we've come. But I think the problem for us in defining fascism is that's how we defined it. And so anything which didn't have that kind of violent street movement was not something that we thought of as fascism. And it was fringe, right? So that meant that your strategy towards it was to try to build a very broad coalition which wouldn't allow them any airspace at all. To defend people on the streets, and there were people defending people on the streets and stopping them actually forming and stopping them marching. But then to say these people cannot speak in the media, politicians cannot have anything to do with them. They cannot speak in our student union, you know, to make clear how extreme they were. And I don't I think we hung on to those tactics for too long and didn't realise that in the meantime, what was a very fringe movement that could be treated like that had become really quite a mainstream movement. And of course, the internet plays a massive role in that, the ability of people with those ideas to whip up other people with those ideas. The fact that we're in an economy which is not growing in the way that the economy was growing in the 90s, and therefore how people feel about their own life and how under attack they feel because of cost of living and whatever. You know, I mean, all of that stuff we may have understood in theory, but I think in practice that was simply not how we saw fascism. Mm. And it seemed like a much easier thing to contain at the time, even though in some ways it was very, very brutal, than dealing with this multi-headed beast that we see in front of us at the moment. And with that, I suppose, you know, there are all manner of new organisations and individuals who represent this trend. And Seema, I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about, you know, the top three far-right politicians or pundits that are shaping narratives globally that still we on the left, we on the progressive side of the movement, spend very little time analysing or understanding.
For sure. And one big figure that looms large is Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister. And Narendra Modi was actually elected, I think, back in 2014. So he's actually one of the first fascist politicians to be very, very successful. And the interesting thing about him is that his political lineage is linked directly to a known fascist party. So there's an organisation called the RSS in India, which was actually responsible for the assassination of Gandhi. And it has a direct historical lineage linked to fascism and this idea of the Aryan supreme race, which is, for those who have studied Nazi Germany, will know that there were actual links between Nazism and this idea of the pure Aryan race. So it's not as far away as we might think, this Indian origin. And I think that's also really key in understanding global fascism today, because it's not simply about white supremacy. It's actually about this deeper idea of blood and soil and nationalism and nation and in-groups and out-groups. And what's interesting about global fascism is that it can be modified and grafted onto any region or any country. And many people say to me, we have to focus on the white working class, or we have to focus on the white man that's supporting reform. But actually, these ideologies are penetrating lots of minoritized and racialized communities. I'm hearing back from Muslim people, from Bangladeshi people, from Uber drivers who listen to LBC, repeating the Farage and the reform talking points. And we're seeing so many, so many quote-unquote Muslim and minoritized people who are now taking positions of leadership in the global far-right and in reform. And so I think someone like Narendra Modi is an example of how fascism has globalized. Another important figure is actually somebody that we do know in the UK. It's Katie Hopkins. And if we remember back to when she was fired as a columnist, it's because she tweeted, "We need a final solution," implying that we needed a final solution to the Muslim problem. And at that point, saying something like that was beyond the pale within the British establishment, and she was fired. And she was saying things like, "We need guns in the channel and we need cannons to shoot migrants because they're like cockroaches." And that was about 10 years ago. And you know what? She's globally famous. She has a YouTube channel that gets broadcast to an Indian audience, and they listen to her talking about how Britain's being taken over by Muslims. So this Islamophobic element is also being globalised and being used. And she's actually quite a popular global figure now. She gets hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube. And then a third figure who I think is quite important is someone like Netanyahu and Israel. And I think we can't ignore the genocide in Palestine, in how it's configured fascism today. And we're seeing Tommy Robinson invited to meet Netanyahu after the synagogue attack that occurred. And we're seeing him distribute Israel flags at the United Kingdom rally. These kind of things are happening. And so there seems to be this concerted global attempt to reinforce different national list configurations, different configurations of ethnic supremacy into an international global movement. And each of these different regions seem to become touchstones and hotspots for connecting that together.
It's really interesting because, I mean, that is a real difference from the 90s. I mean, the idea that all of these groups were kind of linked up and were reinforcing each other. You know, the idea that you would have had people from minority backgrounds, I mean, OK, maybe one or two, but by and large, people from minority backgrounds would not have supported these kind of figures or parties. The idea on far right demonstrations that you had Israeli flags being given out. I mean, it's that is really new and really different. And I think the nationalist international, you know, is one of, very well funded, very well coordinated. One of the things that we've got to be way more aware of. Luke, in terms of the various spaces where far-right ideologies thrive today, maybe you could say something about culturally how the far-right has developed. I mean, you've got, you know, anti-woke and anti-trans and kind of an anti-academic feeling, certainly here in the UK. But then also some of the more conspiracy theorist anti-vax spaces, which is something I never predicted. How is the far-right able to use these kind of narratives?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question because there's something there about the alienation of individuals and how that interacts with the internet. So I often come back to this, and I probably said it at some point on the Another Europe podcast in the past, but the writer and author Hussein Kasvani produced what was, I think to this day, one of the most incredible Guardian long reads that has ever been written in 2019. And we can put it in the show notes. And it's titled something like, When I Met My Far-Right Troll as a Muslim Journalist. So an extraordinary thing to do. He found he was being bombarded in direct messages from an anonymous far-right account called True Brit. And through, you know, we should get him on at some point to talk to him more about it in depth, but decided to take the leap of meeting this person, going to their house, and we definitely don't recommend doing this at home, right? I think it was an incredibly brave and courageous piece of journalism, but went to his house and discovered a really quite vulnerable, broken guy called Phil, I guess it's not his real name, and who had been emotionally broken from a divorce 18 months before. Well, this was in 2019, and he'd spent all of his time watching the Alex Jones show and posting on Reddit and other such channels. And there's something there, I think, about a combination of loneliness and desperation and what's happened to, I guess, masculinity or not having any after all of the transformations we've been through in our economy over many, many decades and the rise of women in the workforce and so on, that the idea of the man as the homeowner no longer quite exists for very good reasons, as it once did, and rightly so. But it's sown a social base for a lot of these discourses and backlashes. And I think these, they're not really movements, are they? All the things you mentioned, but anti-woke, anti-vax, anti-academia. In a way, they're kind of information circulating through digital and online and offline systems. And what it really reminds me of is something that the cultural theorist Stuart Hall talks about, and I'm going to very aggressively popularize or vulgarize it. But he basically says, we don't discover ideology, ideology discovers us. And that's what was basically happened to Phil in that story, right? He was vulnerable, and ideology through these information networks discovered him in this profound and actually really sad and tragic and desperate way.
Right, let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk about odious far-right figures you've probably never heard of.
I'm Alyssa Elliott. Some say we're entering a new age of hard power, where might makes right and despots carve up the world between them. Here on Counterpower, we've got other ideas. As the tyrants face rising resistance, join us to analyze the forces shaping our world and the actions we can take to win real change. The podcast is brought to you by Stop Trump Coalition, Another Europe is Possible, and Global Justice Now, three organizations at the center of the new global resistance. Counterpower isn't just about chatting and conversation, as great as that is. It's about turning ideas into action and building real community power. That's why we have a simple pledge to you, our audience. On every single episode, we'll leave you with something you can do, big or small, to catalyze change. Whether it's the latest big ideas or the movements you need to check out, you'll find them on Counterpower. But we need your help to do all this. We know this podcast has great promise, but to get it off the ground, we need your support. That's why we're aiming to raise £8,000 to kick off this exciting project. To support our launch, please hit the link in the show notes. And don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a positive review. Now, back to the podcast.
Welcome back. For this section, we're going to look a little bit more about British politics. I'm really struck looking at the images we're all seeing at the moment from Minnesota at the difference between living in what we may all regard as a sham democracy and living in what is becoming very rapidly a fascist state, a lawless state where only the rule of the bully exists. What's your take on how, in the event that Reform actually formed a government in this country, they would govern? And how do you see the differences playing out between, for example, figures like Nigel Farage and Tommy Robinson?
Figures like Tommy Robinson and Nigel Farage, they're two sides of the same coin. Farage is there to be the apparently respectable electoral face of the new far right. And Tommy Robinson has historically always been this almost bizarre fringe figure who could never really mobilise more than a few thousand people on the streets. And now that's changed with the Unite the Kingdom rally. And he's got a huge, huge following now, with social media also helping his street movement, his street fascist movement, to burgeon. And while Farage tries to keep a cordon between him and Robinson, they both do interact and complement each other in the rise of fascism today. How would a Reform government actually govern? It would govern incompetently, as we've seen Reform councils governing incompetently. It would govern with a huge, huge increase in racist rhetoric, in violent rhetoric. It would govern with the support of Tommy Robinson's street movement. We've seen thousands of people marching in Crowborough just this weekend, and they do seem to have a decentralised network that's ready to mobilise. Now, how organised is it really? How violent would it actually be? Those are all actually questions that we don't know the answer to. And I want to be careful, actually. I don't want to say this is definitely going to become some kind of civil war situation in the UK. It does look like it's getting to that stage in America. There are some academics who are saying, actually, now that the governor of, I think, Minnesota has called in the National Guard against ICE, that actually the evidence points to civil war being ignited. I don't want to say that that's definitely going to happen here in the UK. I think there is a space for us to stop that happening here. And I think we actually do have to now do what's necessary, do what's needed, and build the anti-racist movement that we need here. We need people in communities organising on the ground, knocking on doors, having those difficult conversations. We need people who are allies and who do have progressive views, but who might have the racist uncle, to be able to have those conversations, to bring people into community. And it isn't just about changing people's ideological views. It's about providing solutions to that material basis that's causing our societal foundations to crumble. It's about an alternative to neoliberalism. It's about reconnecting people into feeling that they are being held within a group, that they aren't out there by themselves suffering from a divorce with none of their kids ever visiting them again. That's what we need to rebuild. And so it's not easy. It takes a lot of hard work. It's not going to happen with us, you know, simply just doing podcasts or digital social media videos, even though that's really great and we definitely should be doing this. It's going to happen when we make those moves on the ground as well. And I can see initiatives springing up to do this kind of work. And I think we do have a window of opportunity now to do that work, but we have to take it because the alternative is something that we can't live with.
Yeah, I mean, I often say to people, it seems at the moment that there are more people in society. I mean, opinion polls would suggest, and my experience would suggest, there are more people, particularly young people, with explicitly left-wing principles and values than there have been at any other time in my life. The problem is almost this sense of defeat and inevitability among those people is the thing that's going to allow this to happen. And so, yeah, I completely agree with you. How we offer people hope and organisation and infrastructure for that is key. I think one of the things that really shocked people in the last 12 months was the Unite the Kingdom rally. We've never seen a far-right demonstration with those kind of numbers and that kind of confidence on the streets of Britain, I don't think ever. Luke, you've got a stronger stomach than me because you watched the whole rally online and wrote about it for the US magazine The Nation afterwards. What was your take?
Yeah, so it was pretty gross, I've got to say, but I didn't quite puke up. But I think judging from the media commentary that was engaging the actual marchers, and I was looking obviously at the top table, it does appear that this really attracted ordinary working class men and women, and that really marked a breakdown. And it wasn't even breakthrough for the far right in this country, and I don't think it was even all white, actually, judging by some of the commentary and some of the vox pops. And I think you mentioned this earlier, like Seema, we shouldn't think that this is a pure white nationalist movement in that regard. Now, it must be said, saying that from the top table, the narrative and arguments put forward were extreme. Like, there was no attempt to tone down the rhetoric. The first element, I think, is what you would expect. It was just hardline anti-Islam politics. But the second element that surprised me was just the extreme religiosity and Christian narratives that were put forward from a number of speakers at the top table. The most bizarre example of this was someone called Brian Tamaki, who is the head of a Pentecostal sect in New Zealand. And he appeared to advocate the creation of some kind of transnational religious ethno state based on the US, New Zealand, the UK, the Anglosphere, if you like. I mean, the most bizarre element of this is that at one point, to create this religious state, he said you'd have to get rid of your royal family. Now, I can't imagine that went down very well with your average Tommy Robinson supporter, so I don't want to over-egg this, but that's an arrival of a British MAGA right there, because it's just has these weird and wonderful, if you like, elements on the fringes within this incoherent far-right movement.
And we've started off in this section talking about British politics, but very, very quickly we've moved on to the global, and that feels significant for me. You can't describe, analyse or deal with this without looking at the global. What's the infrastructure behind this global far-right project?
So I was reading your piece in The Nation, and there are a number of people who are funding this project. And I want to talk about it systemically, because the key funders, one person looms large, someone like Elon Musk, one of the richest men in the world, if not the richest. And he has an ideology. His ideology, he was raised in apartheid South Africa. His parents made their money in apartheid mines. The wealth that he's generated was generated off of the exploitation of racialized labor. And he's taken that ideology back to the States, and he's actively promoting it globally. And this is also seen in America's new colonialism and Trump's new colonialism. This idea that America has the right to invade countries using brute force to occupy them, to extract the resources, and there is no interest in the human rights of the populations living there. It's just about access to minerals in order to supply the AI race and the weapons race. This is the naked ideology that someone like Elon Musk espouses. And underneath that, his material interest as being this tech billionaire that needs access to critical minerals, be that minerals in Ukraine or minerals in Greenland, is driving his financial and structural support for the rise of the far right. And that's the same thing that you can see in some of the other billionaires who are funding it. You mentioned Robert Shulman. He's got an interest. He's on the Friends of the IDF board. And he's got an interest in what's happening in Palestine and that colonization. And again, it's about extracting resources. It's about the climate catastrophe. It's about access to trade routes. It's about oil. And so these are the structural drivers of the global far right. It's capital. It's capitalism. And until we provide the solution and alternative to that, we won't be rid of the far right either.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely this coterie of like powerful individuals and the coterie of the billionaire class that is like pumping this stuff out. I think there's two things. One, the internet has transformed their reach of the traditional extreme right and far right. But secondly, we shouldn't underplay within that context that you can actually make money from this stuff right now. So they're not totally dependent on the Musks of this world. I mean, if you look at someone like Dan Watton, who was kicked out of GB News, I mean, he's built a massive subscriber channel on YouTube now, and it was his live stream that was pumped out from the Unite the Kingdom march to 1.2 million viewers online. So that's a revenue stream for him, in effect.
Right, let's take a break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about the relationship between these new far-right forces and how capitalism is changing.
My name is Julie Ward, and I'm a co-founder of the No to Hassockfield campaign. We're based in County Durham in the north of England, and our campaign is completely focused on shutting down a detention centre for vulnerable women asylum seekers. The site is actually called Derwentside Immigration Removal Centre. But we cannot say no to Derwentside. Derwentside is a beautiful valley. And the site was previously known as Hassockfield Training Centre for Boys, and before that was known as Medemsley Detention Centre. It is a site of historic abuse. So our campaign is focused on creating a regular presence at the centre where we protest in a very creative way. Those demonstrations happen on the third Saturday of every month from 12 until 2. We also have an annual national demonstration on site where people come from all over the country to demonstrate, to sing, to share their stories, to make a lot of noise, and we try to include people with lived experience in these national demonstrations. We'd love you to be one of our supporters and to help us amplify our message. Also, if you can come and be on site with us and take part in our creative resistance, that would be amazing. Sign up to our emails by going to our website, which is www.notahassockfield.org.uk.
So I want to come back to this point that Seema was making, kind of what's driving all of this in the underlying economy. And there's a view that was very prevalent in Germany in the 1930s that fascism was a kind of product of monopoly capitalism, of a very unsustainable form of capitalism that would either die at the hands of a communist revolution, or that could cling on to power through a different political form, a political form that would clear away opposition and that would use state power to bolster the profits of an industry that was struggling ultimately to stay afloat because of the concentration of capital. And it interests me if we're thinking about fascism as we are on this program as more than a street movement. What's the economic form? What's the political form that fascism's taking? And I think Trump's really interesting in this regard. And we've just had Davos the World Economic Forum, at which it seemed like world leaders kind of woken up to the fact that Trump is a serious threat to the world order. But in my opinion, there's still too much thinking that runs along the lines, well, you know, the guy's crazy, the guy's unhinged. He's raising tariffs that are ultimately going to hurt Americans. He's invading countries where, yeah, there's a lot of oil, but it's going to take hundreds of billions of dollars to get that out of the ground. Or, you know, a country where there's lots of critical minerals, but it's going to be a very, very long time before we see any of them. And, you know, you even see individual capitalists in oil companies or whatever kind of disagreeing with him. And I mean, I've got a piece coming out in Tribune that argues that to some degree this misses the point, and that Trump, like fascist leaders before him, is not simply a puppet of individual capitalists. He's trying to reshape capitalism into something else. And for me, that something else is what the fascist economic model looks like. And it's not to say there's a really specific blueprint, but that there is some kind of plan driving on the Trump administration. Luke, I know that you've had disagreements with me on this, so I thought it would be interesting for us to have a bit of that debate on the show.
Yeah, well, I suppose the starting point distinction that I would make maybe is between powerful individuals that are backing him and are very wealthy, and what you could call like the impersonal market. And of course, capital does have institutions that exist to represent a general interest. And in some respects, the World Economic Forum is an example of that, in the same way that we have the Confederation of British Industry in this country. So it brings together some of the wealthiest people in the world to discuss the future of the international order. And it has to be said that Trump got a pretty frosty reception there. And I think most US capitalists are in a position, and investors and the private sector are in a position where they're pretty, in quote marks, scared of this administration, and they're looking to respond in a way that protects their economic interests. So that's I would just say that there's an element of responsiveness from capital towards a politics that's dominant. And so maybe I would, if you're thinking about this in a sort of Marxian lens, maybe invert the relationship between economics and politics, right? That politics is really in command here. But I think that's actually quite consistent with some of the things that you say in your forthcoming piece, Nick. The other thing that I would say, and I guess this links to what Seema was talking about earlier a little bit, I'm definitely a skeptic that there's any economic rationale for taking over Greenland. The minerals that exist are 3 kilometers underground. I found out recently that it doesn't have any roads, so you would have to build a whole transport infrastructure to get them out of the ground. That's even before just needing to bring in a workforce. So that kind of investment takes a very, very long time. And I think Trump has got it into his head, and this is the politics in command bit, that he wants it. And then I think the final point is that you can definitely find these cowboys around different Trumpist initiatives that are looking to make a buck out of it. And I think, as Ann Pettifor argues and others argue, you can make a lot of money from failure. Trump himself has had a litany of failed business projects where he has just extracted a lot of rent up from them and got out. And I think in a lot of these worlds in the last few years, I've been working, doing some stuff in the elite space that is the Ukraine Recovery Conference in my day job. And there's lots of snake oil salesmen there, to be honest, that come out with massive projected figures and have clearly got a bit of money to get things off the ground, but they're narrative builders. They're trying to sell a story about the future. And I guess the job of experts or academics is to come in and say, well, look, is this really a serious story that you're telling? Can you actually do this? And for Trump, I think it's an example of that part of capital is now kind of running an entire country in a way. He's an attention economy capitalist. And I think with the wider US capitalist class, if you like, there's still a lot of reticence and hostility and timidity towards this regime.
Yeah, I think this is really, really interesting. And in terms of how the American economy is affected by some of these policies, they do seem quite irrational. But at the same time, it seems like what Trump is trying to do is put forward this American economic nationalism, where his aggression is also about forcing access for American companies to global markets, forcing access to the Indian digital market, for instance, or to South Africa's digital market. And at the same time, it's interesting how he tries to appease the American population who are suffering from this tariff warfare. For instance, I saw it reported in the Financial Times that he's banned certain commercial developers and real estate companies from buying up homes that would go to first-time family buyers, basically. So he's giving a sop to parts of the American working class and trying to create this almost fascist socialist element of his policies, essentially, in order to keep a part of them consenting to his otherwise seemingly quite irrational project.
It's fascinating. And I mean, I don't know if he's actually going to do that or not, but the fact he said it, and there are very few European Social Democrats who've said they would take a measure like that, is really striking and speaks to how difficult our task is in terms of undermining the fascist moment. And I guess that's why I'd like to end with you both. We've said hope is really important. For each of you, what are you personally planning on doing this year to prevent the kind of bleak scenario we've talked about here? Maybe can inspire our audience.
You should go first, Nick.
I didn't even think I was going to answer that question. So. I'll think about it.
See? Yeah, okay.
I think I need to start talking to people I wouldn't normally talk to. I've already had some conversations at the bus stop in my area, which have been very interesting. People are blaming migrants for the fact that the bus never comes and they're late for work. And I really want to start having more of those conversations in my community and trying to start doing things, even small campaigns locally, to try and change what's happening on the ground for people so that they can see they have power and agency.
Yeah, that's a really good one, actually. And having those difficult conversations with people that you don't normally talk to is great. I think talking to family members, talking to friends around these issues. I will just plug it. Another migrant rights organisation, not JCWI, but Praxis, put out a really interesting guide to how to have challenging conversations that was all about trying to find emotional connection with people that you don't normally talk to or don't normally enter into a political discussion. So having that conversation and using that as the basis to find some element of empathy without having to say, oh, I'm agreeing with you when you're saying something that I find really problematic and even dangerous if it's a really difficult conversation. So, but my one or two things that I'm going to do, I've been giving UNRWA, the Palestinian refugee humanitarian organization that's been repeatedly attempted to be closed down by the Israeli state and is constantly on financial life support. So I've been giving them some money. I'm going to raise my donation in 2026, and I would urge everyone to give them some money. I went to a camp that they were running in Jordan to support the Palestinian population there back in October, and they really are doing incredible work in the most challenging circumstances. And I've heard on the grapevine that Another Europe has a great campaign that's going to be, you can get involved with and promote online about supporting asylum seekers to have the right to work, that most people believe strangely that they do have the right to work, but it's not true. They're banned from taking on PAYE work, which is completely mad and undermines their integration into our society. So Another Europe's going to be raising that this year.
So you've put me on the spot and asked me what I'm going to do, which is fair enough.
You've got loads of interesting stuff coming up with DJN, right?
But look, I think one of the big questions that we face is how we push pressure, demand our governments move away from the relationship that they've currently got with Donald Trump. And ours is one of the worst in the world in terms of an appeasement government that has signed, always been there to sign the first deals with Donald Trump, making it harder for everybody else to stand up and resist. So I think there's a special responsibility on us here in the UK to stop the government from behaving in this way. And I mean, the stuff they've been signing away, including price controls on medicines, including, you know, tech deals, bad in their own right. Now, I think a lot of people think, well, what's the alternative? You've got this guy in the White House. He's clearly got a lot of power. We're going to suffer if we pursue different policies. And so I think part of my job, part of Global Justice Now's role, is to say there is a different way of doing this. There are a whole range of policies that you can begin implementing right now, which would really make his friends in the oligarchy suffer more than anybody else, but also would be good in their own right. Because actually, at the moment, and I think this is deeply unpopular, but it's almost never discussed, many people in this country are incredibly frustrated that we can't make sovereign decisions about our foreign policy or economic policy because of how close we are to the United States. And that precedes Trump by a very long way. So I think beginning to make clear to people, we can declare independence from the United States, and we need to begin doing that right now if we're to weaken this guy, but also just so we can begin living in sovereign democratic countries at very long last, hopefully is a useful contribution to how we begin to undermine the forces at play at this moment. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for joining me, Seema and Luke.
Thank you.
So that's all we've got time for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Counterpower is a fortnightly podcast produced by Another Europe is Possible, Global Justice Now, and the Stop Trump Coalition. Our aim is to bring together experts and activists to talk about global justice and inspire you, our audience, into action. So if you don't know our networks and organisations, look us up. Get involved. There's lots to do. And remember, you can support Counterpower by hitting the link in the show notes for our crowdfunder. We've got a target of £8,000 we're hoping to reach. So please help us kick this project off. And whatever you do, don't forget to like, subscribe and follow Counterpower. Maybe even leave us a nice review. We'll see you again in 2 weeks' time.